Hello and welcome, fellow awesomeologists, to Awesomeology. I'm Sue.
And I'm Ben. And in this episode, we're sitting down with Dr. Richard Kite, director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics in Leadership and endowed professor of ethics at Viterbo University. Author and fellow podcaster. Holy smokes, we got a list behind his name. I like it. Thanks for being here, Rick.
I'm really happy to be here. Thank you both for inviting me.
We're very excited to talk to you. You are an author of several books, your most recent book being Finding Your Third Place, Building Happier Communities, and Making Great Friends Along the Way. That third place, that building community, is something that is incredibly near and dear to our hearts. So we are definitely going to talk about that. But let's start with you, because we're very interested in you as a human being as well. So where does the journey start to take you into the field of ethics and what you're doing now?
You know, so I don't know if you want a short answer or a long answer, because the truth is, I don't really know. So like so many of us, we get into a kind of career, like where do our interests come from? And, you know, and then there's all these accidents that happen along the way too. But I grew up in a very small town, Frazee, Minnesota, in northwestern Minnesota, but, you know, about 50 miles from Fargo. And I had a lot of extended family around. So I remember from an early age just observing people, and had a lot of characters to observe, you know, including some, you know, really good influences and some bad influences. And I remember from an early age just noticing, you know, how some people seemed to do really well in life and be really happy and pleased and enthusiastic about it. And other people like kept making bad choices, you know, and then I think I was also, you know, fortunate to have a mother who was very interested in talking about people and observing, you know, like, why were they doing this? Or why did they act like that? And just having these conversations, but academically, you know, translating that kind of interest in human behavior into something like the philosophical study of ethics kind of happened by accident, but by two things. First of all, discovering the writings of C.S. Lewis when I was in high school and being really interested in trying to find out, like, what did he read when he was young? And it turned out he was reading, like, all these people that we know as like classical thinkers, Plato and Aristotle and Augustine and, you know, and so forth, and not really knowing who they were, but thinking, oh, that'd be really cool to study that. And then when I got into college, had an opportunity to study that because I ran into a really fascinating professor who was a Japanese American who thought it was really important that students read original sources, or what was called primary text. And so I just kept taking classes from him until I was most of the way toward a major and figured, well, I might as well major in this. I've already got, you know, a lot of credits. And I had no plan as an undergrad. And so ended up doing that. And pretty soon I, you know, graduated with a philosophy major, having read, a lot of books that we would call right now classics of Western civilization, but also like having these fascinating discussions about them and just thinking like, it's really interesting how like knowing something that Plato wrote 2000 years ago can really help you to live a better life today. So that's kind of an answer, right?
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot more to it, but that's maybe the shortest version I could tell.
That's a great answer. And I've got to ask, you know, and I love the word accidents along the way to discovering things, or to landing, you know, where we are in life and on our career paths and all of those things. But I have to ask, so you find your way to that major, you graduate school. What's the first job out of college for a guy like Rick Kite?
So I had, you know, I was My dad was a house painter. I started painting with him when I was about 10 years old. Well, I actually didn't get to paint for quite a few years because my job was to scrape and prep and clean up. And
like the fun stuff, kind of stuff
for, yeah. And then I got to, like, and I was fully prepared to, like, go into the trades because I thought, you know, well, I'm going to graduate with a degree in philosophy and it's not good for anything. So, like, what am I going to do? And then I got a call. This is about a month before graduation. I got a call from somebody that I had met the year before asking me if I'd like to go out to Colorado Springs and help her run a miniature golf course for the summer. And so I thought, that sounds much better than painting houses. And so I packed up an old van like a week after graduation, drove to Colorado Springs, rented an apartment, and went into business with the woman who turned out to be my wife. Like we got along in business pretty well, and we thought that seemed like a pretty good foundation for a long-term relationship.
Sure. I've heard you should live with someone before you marry them, or you should go on a road trip with them before you marry them. I haven't heard go into business with them before you marry them. Yeah. So that's a new one for me.
Yeah. Like it puts you through a lot of tests.
Yeah.
Right. In a short period of time. And like one of the main causes of breakups is financial disagreements. Right.
Sure.
And so you're making financial decisions all the time when you're running a business together. So if you can do that and still be happy, that's a pretty good test.
That's a good sign. Yeah. So let's jump ahead a little bit. How does this study of ethics tie to this concept of a third place that you've been spending some time with more recently?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's a question not too many people have asked me. It goes right to the heart of what ethics is about. If we think of ethics as it was classically understood, if you go way back to Aristotle, for example, he thought ethics, what it really amounted to is that, like, is studying the what is the point of life, what is our reason for living, and the whole point of life was what he called eudaimonia, which is usually translated as happiness or flourishing, something like that. And so I think he was right about that, like, ethics isn't just about doing what's right. It's about living a life of integrity, a life in which we flourish. And when what we find out is we can't flourish alone. We can only flourish together. And so you have to live a life in which you are committed to the common good and committed to the thriving or the flourishing of the community in which one resides. And what we've seen recently over the past several decades is a real real challenges to this idea of community and to the very possibility of social connection. And we're especially finding young people are in crisis right now because of the lack of opportunities and skills for social connection. And so this idea of a third place, if we think of home as first place, work is second place, third place is where we go to socialize. Those are the places set aside in our communities for building social connection. And we're losing them. And that's a really a good way to talk about like the vital importance in our lives of having those places and then deliberately cultivating social connection for the sake of happiness, right? So that's like, So I see it as being about the very heart of ethics is how we build connections with others and build positive connections.
So a question about that third place. When did we stop building them? I want to make this a good question, Rick, but I don't know if it is. We have heard so much about trying to invigorate this third space, right?
Yeah.
When did it start to die? Did we intentionally, was there a time we were intentionally building them? This is so many questions. And what happened to that we stopped? Does that?
Yes.
The through line there was complicated. So, but no, you're a professor, you understand it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, yeah, it seems like, so if you go back through human history, as far as you go, like every kind of society, any culture that has flourished has had really meaningful public places where people gather and make connections. One of the things that happened in American society, and this we could say like Western societies generally, is that in the process of industrialization, our lives became both busier and more prosperous. And we started really separating in a way like workplaces and private spaces. These both really developed fast. Like there was a lot more homes and better homes and bigger homes than they kept like throughout the whole history of industrialization. They keep our private spaces get better and more opulent. And also our workplaces get bigger and more productive and so forth. And so what happened is the importance of the public spaces started to shrink. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it seemed like people were really invested in saying, well, those public spaces are shrinking, but we've got to find ways of connection. So you have all the way through like the early parts of like the late 1800s, the early 1900s, up until, and I would say through World War II, people were starting clubs and organizations, and they were building a lot of churches. They were building a lot of places for people to gather outside of home and outside of work. So that there was a period in American life, at least, where that really flourished, and it seems to have been on the decline ever since maybe the end of the 50s. Mm. So it's hard to say when that happened because the decline happens differently for different kinds of organizations and different kinds of places. And it happened at different speeds in rural areas and in urban areas. But if we start tracking like what we call civic participation, like how much do people get to know their neighbors and join groups and do all the sorts of things that we do in third places, that has declined every decade since the 1950s.
So not a brand new phenomenon.
No.
But maybe, yeah. Maybe pushed forward or expedited through these online spaces and places, things that were created digitally to simulate,
yep,
socialness, but aren't really social?
Well, I think it started to decline significantly with television, because television became a way for people to stay at home and have private entertainment.
Mm.
Where private entertainment wasn't really you could go home and read a book. You could listen to some radio programs, but, you know, like how many times are you going to listen to The Lone Ranger or The Shadow or something, right?
Yeah.
Like, so that's still limited. Right? And so people were still getting together to play cards and just to visit and all that. But with television, like you really start to get a decline. So that's happening in the 60s, right? And then the 70s. And then you get the personal computer. And you get online forums, and then you get iPads, and you get smartphones and social media. And then we start to see a real decline in both public spaces, I would say third places especially, because they can be private, but they're for social connection, mm-hmm, like cafes and coffee shops and taverns and gyms and all these things. So what we see is we see a start of a decline after World War II, but you're right, it really accelerates, especially over the last, say, three decades.
I've seen you speak a bit about how this is impacting the like younger generations, even though it's certainly not isolated to them. I don't want to make it all doom and gloom, but what would you say, like, what's the data point or the bit of research that you've seen or been a part of that is most concerning to you, either in the moment or something that even you've discovered sometime recently that is worth sharing?
Well, yeah, really two things. The way in which young people are spending time, so we're seeing really like huge, massive increases since 2011, like huge increases every year, especially among Gen Z on the amount of time they spend in digital spaces. So that's largely on smartphones and gaming and social media. Right. And then along with that comes a real decline in the amount of time spent with friends and spent in what's sometimes called unstructured play, just like hanging out.
Yeah.
And those have had real negative effects on especially the mental health of that generation. The other, I think, data point that I find really fascinating, just a very recent survey on what young people want when teenagers are asked, like, what do they most want in their life? What they say is unsupervised time with friends.
Hmm.
They don't want time alone. They don't want more time on social media. So like they want their parents to step back a little bit and let them hang out with friends. And so I think that's a really good thing to know. Like, they want more of the very thing that has declined for them, mm-hmm. and which has proven to be really beneficial. And so I think we're going to see a pendulum shift. I think, like, if adults allow it, right,
yeah,
we'll see a shift to more time spent hanging out with friends.
Well, I'm glad you ended on that note, because my follow-up was going to be, now give me the hopeful thing. What's the solution or the next thing that's going to, you know, correct that? And I mean, as a dad of a 9 and 3-year-old right now, obviously more so with the 9-year-old who's certainly, you know, developing his social circles and things like that. Just in my observation, I think I can echo and confirm what you're sharing, that, you know, that time where it's just him and a buddy or him and a group of folks, where it's not a coach or a parent or even an aunt or an uncle or somebody that's right there with them. The opportunities, I think, are few and far between, because we've created this world where they're always busy doing something, whether that's school or youth sports or time on screens or on, you know, digital platforms and things like that, you know, just time in the basement chilling and hanging out or out back imagining things. You know, we haven't done a great job of making those opportunities for them. So it's cool to know that they're hungry for it.
Yeah, they're hungry for it. And I think, so the opportunity is, like, adults, I think adults in general, and especially parents, have to stop overestimating the dangers of letting kids hang out unsupervised. And they should stop underestimating the dangers of the digital world.
Mm. Yeah.
Because there's real dangers there that are not sufficiently appreciated, and of a variety of sorts, right? And so your kids are much better off and they want it. I mean, that's the good news, is they also want that. So that's.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to throw a curveball in here. We are a marketing agency, a creative agency. So we're creating things all the time. And, you know, a big part of our job is influencing people to do a thing, to buy a thing, to fill out a form, whatever it might be. Can you, if somebody's asked you this question already, you got to let me know their name, because we need to hook up. But can you connect this, I mean, either the ethics space that you're doing so much great work in, or this topic of third spaces, can you connect it to marketing and how we're doing? Like, either something that you found that would be, you know, helpful insight for a marketer to be aware of as they're thinking about whatever their next creative project, their next campaign, as they're considering their audiences and things like that. Is there anything that you've been able to make a connection to or spoken on before?
Well, you know, one of the things that distresses me sometimes about the world we're living in is I think that it's too much driven by marketing, that marketing shapes the message instead of the message shaping the marketing, mm-hmm. right? And this is not really for the people who are in the marketing business like you. This is like for all of us, like we should get first things first. Like first things first is we should figure out what kind of life we want to lead. And then we should figure out like how do we promote the kinds of things that we really need to live that good life. And I see this especially like in the world where kind of we're entering into this AI world where we're seeing all kinds of hype and promotion for AI. And the people who are creating it are themselves saying, like, this could destroy the world. Like, how do we get involved in a world in which we're actively marketing a product that we think could destroy us? Like, mm-hmm. that makes no sense, right? So that's the old phrase is putting the cart before the horse.
Sure.
Like, we have all sorts of things that we do in this world that like we should be doing because we think they're really important. And my own world is education. And I find so often that we're so focusing on branding what we do as a university that we forget to have discussions about, but what do we want our students to become? Like, what kind of people do we want them to become? And then market ourselves as the place that tries to do that rather than thinking, like, first of all, we have to figure out how to market ourselves. And then we figure out what, so then once we've marketed ourselves that way, what should we teach? Like, that gets things backwards. And I think it's not good for the marketing profession either. Like, the marketing profession should be one which serves people, serves their fundamental needs, right? To let people know about what is out there that is good, that can benefit them in some way.
Right.
Yeah.
That's high level thinking about marketing, right?
Yeah. But I think we completely agree. I think, you know, we try really hard, and obviously we're not perfect. No one's perfect. But we pride ourselves on being ethical in what we're doing and understanding that our job is not to create need. It's to connect people to the things that will make their lives better. Now, there is a slippery slope there. So who's deciding what is your better and what is making people's lives better? And in the hands of an unethical person, that can be a really tricky question to just let lie out there. But that's definitely something we believe, that we wouldn't support, you know, we wouldn't do work for something that we think will hurt people. And but that's actually been, isn't that just something we were talking about as we were talking about the different clients we could be talking to and where do we draw the line? Because an awful lot of people need marketing, right. But not all of the people that need marketing are doing something that we think is making the world better. And what line would we draw? And it would be, if you're making the world worse, we're not working for you.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, as we're busier and busier and our people's capacity is filling up and stuff, like, we'll have to make decisions, right? And sometimes, the decision might be a client that's more profitable in one way or the other. But also, like, that can't be the only point of consideration. The other might be, you know, does this client's values align with ours, you know, and are they yeah, selling a product or a service that's generally doing good or connecting people to something that they need, you know. And, you know, I suppose a challenge that we have, whether we're talking about our credit union clients that are selling, you know, checking accounts and loans and deposit products and all kinds of stuff, or a small business client selling a widget of some kind, you know, I suppose every industry that we serve probably has some level of their products being a true need to a certain audience, and then maybe a want or something that could actually harm other folks. You know, I'll use an auto loan from a credit union as an example, right? I mean, there's some folks that absolutely need that thing. It's access to their job or to, you know, whatever that having that car means for them. For others, it's, you know, the auto loan from the credit union might mean a significant dollar savings to them monthly. That means, you know, they've got extra money in their pocket to whatever, feed themselves, feed their kids, give an opportunity, whatever. But there's others that also like don't need that thing. And, you know, actually them getting that auto loan means they're putting themselves in a debt situation that they do not need to be in, you know. So it's the same product, you know, maybe even the same rate, exact same parameters, but it can do one thing or another to people. And I do think, you know, we are very happy and fortunate to work in the credit union movement where, you know, generally, and again, nobody's perfect, we are looking out for people's best interests. You know, we live by that people over profit, you know, mentality. And I think we're doing good for people. And again, you know, of course there's outliers, but so that brings a challenge to the work that we do, whether it's, you know, us vetting out a client or us selling our products and services or marketing products and services in a way that, you know, really is for good.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And it's hard because we also want to live in a society in which we give individuals a wide range of choices and respect their freedom to choice without determining their choices for them. But that means that sometimes people are going to make what we consider to be bad choices. And you know, that's not my job to constrain their choices. Although I think it is my job sometimes, like as a person who teaches ethics, to be critical at times, right?
Yeah.
But this puts marketing in a really interesting kind of ethical position in society, in which you are, in a way, you're in the business of optimizing people's choices. So you're optimizing freedom, which in general is a good thing, but might be exercised in irresponsible ways by some. And that's just part of it, right? You just accept that. That's part of the business. But I just, like, generally, I think we've turned into society that's fairly unreflective about first things, like even having a discussion of what are people's needs. What are the basic needs we have, and how do we pursue a life in which we prioritize those needs? This is something I don't hear people talking about very much, and I think it should be a matter of daily conversation.
So what would a conversation like that sound like? Who should be having those conversations? What should they, in your opinion, if you could lead people to the right choice, the quote unquote right choice, what would that sound like?
Well, what it would sound like is like daily just having all kinds of small conversations about the things that we choose at different times, and like what we choose to eat and why, what kind of clothes we choose to buy, whether we need a new car or not, or can it would be better off kind of nursing along this old vehicle that needs a lot of repairs. Like these are the sorts of conversations that one has kind of naturally, I think, among groups of friends. Like when you get to coffee together for coffee, you just talk about this stuff, and it all seems like at the moment, it might seem kind of trivial, right? And yet, over the course of a lifetime, all these small choices we make add up to, like they add up to a life that is focused on some sorts of things rather than others, and lives that end up being like fairly happy or not at all, or sometimes helping others out or not helping others out. And so that's coming back to this idea of third places. This is where third places become really important, because they give us a chance to just have these small conversations which we're always processing, the little choices we're making throughout our life. And when we're talking about those things, what we're doing is actually distinguishing between what do we need versus what do we want, and what kind of wants are like well-grounded. Hmm. And so let me give you an example. I just saw a post recently of something that's becoming viral in the college world, is designer dorm rooms. It's like these young people are moving into the dorm rooms and then sharing photos where they've, you know, like brought in special furniture and, you know, duvet covers for their beds and, you know, all this stuff where they spent like thousands of dollars outfitting this room so it looks immaculate. I've never seen an actual student dorm room that looks like that, but this has become a thing now on the internet, like spreading these photos, these images that go, which creates the impression that students, like that's what the standard is, and you've got to outfit your room or you're really behind it. And yet it's just not true. And the other thing is it's really wasteful.
Yeah.
Like if you're going to college, don't worry about, you know, does your bedspread match your, you know, lampshade or whatever? Like it really doesn't matter. Yeah. Like focus on things that matter, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so this is one of the ways in which I think social media can kind of contaminate one's world, is it disconnects you from reality. Mm-hmm. And when you're disconnected from reality, you can't make good decisions about what we need versus what we want.
The whole time you're talking, I'm just picturing my college dorm room, and it's so far from designer that I can't help designer, but laugh about it. Yeah.
I know. And like every dorm room I've ever seen, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
They're disasters.
And in fact, you kind of take pride in the disaster and the fact that half of the stuff in there was from a garage sale and, you know, everything else that most of us experience in our dorm room.
Yeah.
So what I think I'm hearing you say is, yeah, and I'm applying this to the idea of what we do in marketing, is that messages like that, those viral images, people are sharing them, they give the impression of a paucity of choice. You do not have a choice. You have to have a designer dorm room, or, you know, this other, you have to buy a new car. They take those choices away from people. And if people are isolating themselves, they assume that that message is correct, rather than turning to a friend and saying, you know, I was really thinking I should spend twice my yearly salary on a vehicle because I saw that on TV and I was told that that's the right thing to do. And to have a friend to go, that sounds insane and you shouldn't do that, is what helps us create these healthy choices and regrounds us. And when we are pulled away from this impression that we don't have a choice, that we have to meet that status quo. Am I picking that up? Am I learning, Professor?
No, I think, exactly. I think that's exactly right. And I think there's ways of doing marketing that kind of, that educates or informs and clarifies for people.
Mm.
And there's kinds of marketing that manipulates.
Yeah.
And I think like what happens a lot of times when we're talking about viral images, especially like viral images on social media, a lot of that is manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's problematic because it doesn't represent what's really going on in the world.
Yeah.
So let's not do that, Ben.
I'm in. Sounds
okay.
Good.
Okay. Done. Well, that's a really good place to segue into the big question then. We've talked a lot about a lot of different things. And you have such a wealth of expertise. Honestly, as I was writing these, you know, the notes for our discussion today, I couldn't even anticipate, you know, you have so much research and you're already putting so much valuable information out. I couldn't decide what is the question to ask this guy. So I thought we could open the floor up. What's the most important thing? Let's assume that this podcast, wouldn't this be nice, goes out to everyone in the world. The message that you would love people in the world to get right now.
I would say make your life deliberate. And so much of our life is mediated right now, right, by technology. That when you make your life deliberate, what you do is you emphasize real experiences with real people. And that's kind of become my tagline. Like right now, when people ask me, like, what's my advice? I say, have real experiences with real people. And it is so refreshing. So, Ben, you were at a Rotary conference where I spoke.
Yeah.
And afterwards, there was an exchange student from Brazil who came up to me, all excited, because I was talking about like the importance of friendship, going to third places, joining organizations, that sort of thing. But real experiences with real people, that's what I was emphasizing. She came up, she was all excited. She said, I used to spend 14 hours a day on my phone.
Eesh.
Now I'm down to 4 and I'm so much happier. And I'm thinking, 4 seems like an awful lot,
but yeah,
you know, a lot better than 14. And she said, I'm going to try to get it down to 2. But she was so excited because what I'd been saying was affirming what she had been trying to do in her life is get off of the digital device and spend more time with real people. And she was just saying like how much her life was better because of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is something that pretty much every previous generation just kind of took for granted, because what else are you going to do? Like, yeah, like that's, in some ways it's a low bar, real experiences with real people, because it's what everybody throughout history has always done.
Right.
And yet that's something to aim for right now. And I think it's really important. So
yeah,
comes down to, that's the first step.
I love all that. I love the message of, you know, first things first, that we've heard today. The idea of living your life deliberately, something that I won't claim to be running my life through this filter every day, but something that I'm trying to remind myself of more and more often is, am I or is someone else better because I have done blank, fill in the blank, you know? And, you know, we maybe get stuck on social media. And, you know, when we talk about digital experiences and Gen Z and all that, you know, it's easy to go to social media and that being the root of all evil, you know, and all of that. But asking myself that question about my experiences digitally and on social media and stuff, it's not very often that I can answer that question with a resounding yes. Am I better or is somebody else better because I have just spent 4 hours on my device, or, you know, been on scrolling on social media, stuck in the reels, or, you know, entertained by that viral thing. And that is the thing, you know, there certainly are opportunities for entertainment and such, but there's others, other sources for that entertainment and, you know, real experiences with real people. Even though both of those things, the digital experience or those real experiences might be entertaining, there is one that's better. And oftentimes it's the real one. With real people, right?
And it gives you opportunities to be useful to somebody. So yeah. Like when you commit yourself to showing up for other people, what happens is you develop a relationship in which others end up depending on you for something. And without even necessarily choosing it or deciding it, you end up being very helpful. So that question you ask, am I doing something that's actually helpful that makes other people's lives better? When you develop relationships, you end up doing things that are quite useful. And this is one of the saddest surveys that we see in our society right now is how so many young people find themselves to be useless. Mm. Like nobody needs them. And if you aren't interacting with real people in real ways, it's very hard to be useful to anybody.
Yeah.
And so that's the first step. And then what you find out is that you start interacting with people and suddenly you are useful because you're there when they need something and you're in a position to help. So like what you said about like going through your day and asking, like, am I making somebody's life better, right? You're going to have a lot of opportunities to do that if you're committing yourself to spending time with people.
Yeah. Well, gosh, I wish we had like two more hours with you.
So much awesome. To think about already. Right?
Before we transition to our closing segment, how can people learn more about you? What other things would you like people to get connected to?
Yeah, so my book, Finding Your Third Place, that like people can buy that in bookstores or online, you know, at any kind of seller. So that's widely available. And then I also have a website, richardkite.net. And I'm easy to find at the Viterbo University website also. So yeah. if somebody goes there. So pretty easy to find. Richard Kite, people can Google that. And it's not a real common name.
Yeah, that's K-Y-T-E.
Right. K-Y-T-E, yep.
Yeah. Awesome. All right, well, let's start to round this out. We'll shift into our Something Awesome segment where we share recommendations for anything awesome in life right now. Cool books, good watches, cool experiences, whatever it might be. I'll kick it off. And gosh, after the conversation today, I feel almost silly sharing this, but I have to. I've got young kids and we like a good animated movie, and it's trending a lot right now, but there's this Netflix movie called K-Pop Demon Hunters. And as to the point and awkward as the title is, it's an amazing story full of lots of lessons, good lessons for kids, good lessons for parents. The animation's cool and the music is like, it's like leading in the Billboard lists and stuff now, which for an animated Netflix movie is just kind of crazy, but, so much to love about it. And basically any, quiet time in the house is filled with the soundtrack playing and with two young kids that are all about dancing and singing along. It's pretty awesome and adorable to watch as a parent too. So not only is the show good, but there's some good ancillary benefits there too with the kids picking up on it. But
it's entertaining for the parents as well as the kids. Is that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's one of those, you know, kind of like lost art right now, a quick watch, right? You know, it's a movie that's only an hour and 20 minutes long or something, you know, which is a nice thing because, you know, lately, it seems like anything that winds up in the theaters and such, it's like 2 hours minimum, you know, so.
Right.
Yeah. Did you bring anything for us, Rick, or you got something to share?
Yeah. So a couple things. So this is not a kid's movie at all, but I would say over the last couple of years, the best movie I've seen, the one I keep thinking about over and over, is called Perfect Days. It's by the director Wim Wenders. And it is about, see, if I tell you what it's about, you probably won't watch it because it sounds like the most boring movie in the world. It is about a public toilet cleaner in Tokyo and following him as he goes about his job. Now, it gets more involved in that. But the movie is beautiful because here it follows somebody who takes what we would think is a very disagreeable kind of job, and he takes it with, he does it with reverence. Like his job to make this little part of the city more beautiful, to make it clean and to be ready for the visitors who are going to stop in the public bathrooms. And then he gets, it follows him through during his interactions and to the little third place that he goes to every day and all these things. Anyway, it's a beautiful movie, and it made me so happy to watch it. And I think about it all the time because it just makes me smile.
Yeah.
So I don't think the kids would enjoy it so much.
No, but we'll
there's
be
no
checking.
Demons, like no action, no dance tunes.
Yeah.
But there's good music in it. One other recommendation, and I would say, like, anybody who's kind of interested in some of the things I was talking about, Ralph Waldo Emerson's essays are entirely overlooked by this generation of people. And they are beautiful. They're the most exquisite pieces of writing. They're fairly short essays. We know Emerson mainly as somebody who delivered all these quotes. And if you look for Emerson quotes, you'll find thousands of them on the internet. But I love his essays, and I've been returning to them for 3 decades now, and they always seem fresh. And so I keep recommending them to people. If you were a reader at all, go back and give those a look. You probably haven't even thought about them maybe since high school or college, but they're beautiful.
Awesome. Excellent recommendations. Thank you, Rick. So I'll cap us off. I am very excited. And I think strictly speaking, my recommendation is if someone is looking for a cause to support, but then I also will say that I am currently extremely biased. So my recommendation is to check out, if you have not heard of it, the Never Forgotten Honor Flight. I'm so excited about this. So my dad was in the Navy in Vietnam, and he just turned 82. And in October, he and I are going to get to go on this Never Forgotten Honor Flight. And they fly the veterans to Washington, D.C. They tour, among other things, the Vietnam Memorial, and they get to spend time there. They make the whole day really about the veterans. And I'm lucky enough that I got chosen to go as a guardian, so I get to go and sort of usher him and another veteran potentially through this experience. And it's just, it's a very cool organization. They do a ton of fundraising. I found out you can buy things from their store, which also benefits the organization. Things like hats and jackets and t-shirts too. So if it is anything that anyone's looking for, an opportunity to make a charitable donation, support a pretty cool cause, that is the one. My highly biased recommendation, Never Forgotten Honor Flight, is one to get involved with. So
yeah, that's an awesome recommendation. A great share. I'm so excited for your dad, but Sue, I'm so excited for you to be able to get to go along as a guardian and stuff. What a cool experience for you to be there with your dad, and you know, I'm sure meet other people and stuff too. So I'm so excited for you. I can't wait to hear how it goes.
That is really fantastic. Like it, that's life changing for people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And he doesn't listen to this, so I can speak frankly about him. he has not been excited about things for quite a while, and he's mm-hmm. really excited about this. So
that's great.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's wrap this up before Sue gets too steamy.
Yeah.
I'm emotional.
That's just how I get. Thank you for being with us today, Rick. What an excellent conversation. I do hope that we get another opportunity to connect and have you come back and talk some more. You should write another book so that we can immediately have you back.
Okay. That's a good incentive.
It's just that easy.
But thank you. This is a wonderful conversation. Your questions are so thoughtful. So thank you.
Thank you. And thank you to everyone for joining us. We'd love to have you here with us. We'd love to have you get to hear some of these wonderful guests like Rick with so much to share. You can always catch up on your favorite podcast app. And you can always also find all of our past episodes. We had a lot of really excellent guests. We're pretty proud being able to talk to some of the smartest, coolest, most interesting people. And you can see and hear all of that at our blog, exclamationcuso.com/blog.
Thanks again, Rick. Thanks, friends, for tuning in. Be awesome and see you next time. The Awesomeology Podcast is a production of Exclamation Services. Executive producers are myself, Ben Bauer, and my friend, Suzanne Campbell.
Thanks to Kyla Ganther for our show artwork, Scott Sager for booking our guests, and Alex Westerhausen for social media support.